Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from the top of the village in Southbury, Connecticut. In this month's episode, our 45th, we return to the conversation with renowned geographer Yifu Tuan in our second part of the series, which we call Geographies of Nothing. Stay tuned. Welcome to Geographies of Nothing. Continue our conversation with Yifu Tuan. We suggest that you listen to the first part of the series, episode 44, Geographies of Everything, to get a little bit of the context of the second part of this same conversation. In the first part of this two-episode series, we explored with Dr. Tuan the concepts of space and place. We discussed offices, Madison, Wisconsin, film, deserts. In this second part of our two-part series, this called now Geographies of Nothing, we explore the influence of J.K. Wright and the concept of geosophy on Tuan's own work. We look at the books Humanist Geography and Romantic Geography. We discuss how both are offering up something beyond the human geography of today. We go back and look at the definition of what geography means and how that's related to home. Look at the effect National Geographic has had on the imaginations of home for its readers. And then we end with a conversation about belonging and routine. Let's go back to Yifu Tuan. One of the favorites on the show is J.K. Wright. And I know you're J.K. Wright professor
at
Madison. And the idea of geosophy, the idea of a geography from any and all points of view, much more of a subjective, individual, perhaps, approach to the multitude or multiplicity of geographies that exist. How much has his work influenced you in terms of, I don't know, thinking about this, you know, your most recent book is Humanist Geography, An Individual Search for Meaning. I mean, here in the title of the book is this individual's search for meaning. How much of geography really is individual? I mean, we come to terms and agree upon so much. But in the end, your looking at the desert is probably very different than most people's. The way that desert has been codified is more of this death sort of landscape. Everything is dead and there's no water, there's no life, but yet you're seeing it teeming with life. You know, how important is the individual's geography here?
Yeah, well, My love for the desert, for the mineral, deathless nature of that environment is not all that common, but it certainly exists. In fact, just one example, Lawrence of Arabia, he actually articulated what I tried to say earlier, but much more eloquently. About why he's at home and loves the desert. And it comes down to something that's not widely shared, but it's kind of a contempt for the body, for the weakness of biology. I mean, his own body that he wants to transcend.
Yeah, I mean, the desert comes into religious traditions too as this place,
right?
Of
yeah,
the ascetic sort of experience of, and maybe a lot in Christianity, but I don't think it's limited to Christianity now, is it? I mean, Islam as well. Mecca's in the middle of the desert, and these pilgrimage places are modern pilgrimage locations, or the sacred spaces of contemporary sacred spaces are places of desert and were places of contemplation in the past.
Correct, and that's because religion, certainly the major religions, are in the attempt to go beyond or to transcend the biological.
Yeah.
The biological requires and nurturing, accommodating environment where we can make a living, raise a family.
Right.
And that's life. But religion seeks to go beyond that and say, surely there's more than that. So.
Yeah. Dennis Wood reviewed your Humanist Geography book, The Individual Search for Meaning, and said it was a great, for those who have followed your work throughout your career, it's a great sort of bringing together a lot of the major themes. Is that a, of your own work, the major themes of your own work, is that a fair review? And could you tell us a little bit more about the book, This Search for Meaning?
Yes, I started to write the Humanist Geography thinking that it could be a textbook for a sub-discipline. Then I thought, well, if one writes, say, a textbook on physical geography, I think there's general agreement as to what should be in it.
Right.
But Humanist Geography, there's no such general agreement. I realized that as I started to write this book.
Yeah.
So I said, well, I better be frank and say that in the end, this is a personal search for meaning. But I intended it originally as a textbook. And that's why I started in Humanist Geography with what is distinctive about human, and what is distinctive are our senses. Or start with the senses, the traditional five senses, and how these senses give us a world. But the senses are supplemented by the mind. That's where the imagination comes in.
Yeah.
But the senses themselves are, to me, fascinating, and I can't quite understand why it hasn't caught on in the teaching of human geography, because it's just so inadequate or abstract to just think of landscape as something visual. It's far more than that. It's textual. It's auditory. You can smell it. You can hear sounds in it. Everything makes the landscape, the world we're in, come to life. That comes down to what I try to do in space and place. I call it the experiential perspective, experience.
Right.
So when humans experience the world, reality, it's not just visual, far from it. But the other senses, the importance of the other senses, was vivid to me when I lived in a high-rise building in Minneapolis, and my apartment was on the 10th floor, and I would look through the window to the downtown Minneapolis, yeah. And I can see cars moving, pedestrians. But then I opened the window, and suddenly it comes to life. I mean, when I just see them, even the movement doesn't seem real until it comes to life and I can hear the sound of the cars moving, the noise of the traffic makes it so much more real. So now sight is complemented by sound, but there are the other senses as well. If you were offered a horrible choice to be either blind or to be deaf, most people would say, well, this is horrible, but I don't want to be blind, because blind, suddenly the whole world is wiped out. Whereas if I were deaf, I can still see, you see. And that's true. Most people feel that. And at first, the blind are more shocked, feel deprived than the deaf. But it said that eventually the deaf suffer more because of the way sound gives life. One of the things that is critically important to us is to hear the sound of human voice.
Yeah. The soothing voice of someone you know, or
right, yes, and yeah. Well, of course, music and so on. But so to come back to the book Humanist Geography, I thought a way to start Humanist Geography would be to talk about these senses, and then how mind affect the input of the mind, and so on and so forth. So I thought this was a logical pattern of topics for humanist geography. And then I realized that my fellow humanist geographers would not follow. I mean, they have their own schema. And so that's why I had to put the subtitle that is personal experience, personal exploration, search for meaning.
Right. You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. It's funny because you brought up the physical geography textbook example. The schema of that is sort of, it's much more determined, isn't it? The sort of,
right,
goes hand in hand with right, sort of the positive approach and positivist approach. And here, to be humanist geography, there's no textbook, is there? Or there's a reader for sure that could help one in those explorations, but there's probably multiple textbooks, like you're saying. I think that's
right. People's point of departure is different, and then the whole schema is different. It's just that I naively thought that as humanists, humanist geography, surely we would start with what is distinctive about the human experience, which depends on the senses and the mind.
Yeah.
So I thought one would start with the senses and then move to the mind and so on and so forth.
In the mind, are we talking here about imagination. My favorite definition of imagination is the ability to form images and ideas of things not yet experienced or seen. I mean, is that a human faculty? Is that something that we have, that we're able to imagine? We're able to put together, piece together something without having seen or smelled or, you know, or touched it?
Well, that's the sense of imagination that I was trying to bring out in talking about migration.
Yeah.
That is, we haven't been there. We're just imagining what the place would be like. And our imagination there can be a real agent in pushing us to move. And so that's distinctive to humans. And that, I think, is what is generally known, meant when geographers talk about geographical imagination. I find that hard to separate. In fact, I don't separate imagination with the mind.
Yeah.
It takes the mind to be imaginative. And the mind operates everywhere. So at the start, I talk about senses, which seems to be a biological competence of humans, the way we see and hear. But it's almost impossible to describe what the senses offer without realizing the senses are greatly directed, affected by the mind, by imagination. So
there's feedback there, yeah.
A table may be made of glass. Tabletop is glass, and it's appealing, and it's cool, but my imagination is that it could shatter, and that's very disturbing. I mean, wood, something made of wood, seems solid and comforting. It's not going to shatter.
Right.
So that thing, I think, is pretty much where imagination offers, because visually, or tactually, you know, it's a cool, hard object. It looks great. Shattering is what I put in imaginatively.
So in this search for meaning, then, to take the subtitle of the book here a little bit, the individual search for meaning, is part of that search sort of unpacking our own imagination or geographical imagination?
The search for meaning is that, well, again, I start with the senses, and then I say the senses, human senses are enormously affected by the fact that we have the mind or intelligence. And the mind and the imagination are pretty close.
Yeah.
And so that leads us beyond what is presently there to what might be, what's out there. That basically leads me to the idea that humans transcend the biological. That's where, in the book too, where architecture comes in. Architecture as distinct from buildings. Termites in Australia create skyscrapers. I mean, there's
right. Skyscrapers.
Just incredible. But I assume that the termites don't have transcendental aspiration. Somehow they just managed to build it. It's not a plan, they designed it.
Right.
They say, it's not that they say, well, we have caves and huts, but that's not enough for us. We need something transcend that. But for humans, that's the case. I mean, we don't need to live in skyscrapers. We don't need cathedrals. I mean, by that, I mean we don't need them to survive, to maintain this, the species over time. We transcend the biological.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. Right.
I submitted this manuscript to Minnesota, University of Minnesota Press. I was a faculty there, and they published several of my books. I knew they would be sympathetic. I know the editor well. But it took him a long time to respond whether they would accept it or not. But then eventually, I got a letter from the editor saying nice things about how well written it is and so on. But he, in the end, didn't accept it. And the reason he gave was kind of interesting. And the reason is basically, although the book is called Romantic Geography, it's really, he felt an attack on geography. And then I thought he has a point, because in the book I have a section about what geography is, and that geography basically is how living things, living animals, humans, survive. So the basics of geography is to find a nurturing a place where we can recuperate and survive, and but also know what to do to find food. So nurturing home and going out into space to find food at the essence of what animals do.
Right.
So I'm saying that geography is universal. It's not confined to humans. Animals have to know geography to survive. So they have to build nests and caves where they feel safe and go out for food. They courtship, they mate, marry, and then
right.
You know, so the cycle goes on, and that's what we do, too. But I'm saying that basically a great deal of human geography is that, how we humans, human geography is essentially economic geography.
Well, that's what it's
economic
turned into,
and social geography.
Right.
An effort to build homes and to find food and to survive.
Yeah.
Geography
is the study of Earth as home, right? Earth as home, essentially.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, but the book Romantic Geography says that it's beyond that. I mean, at the center, it is that we can say that all animals, including humans, seek home and survival. But humans do things beyond that, which is hard to explain. So romantic geography is essentially geography of people going to places that are totally unsympathetic, like deserts and mm-hmm. and ice peaks and forests, so on. Basically, it's kind of a geography of exploration, of adventure that seems to have not much to do with just survival. In fact, it's the opposite. They go out risking their lives. Just the opposite of nurturing and survival. And that's what I call, romantic geography. But few of us do that. I've been watching the movie of Shackleton's adventure in Antarctica. Such enormous suffering and for something that's not exactly nurturing or useful. So that's what I call romantic geography. But that's the kind of transcendence that I'm after. Which has a religious aspect.
If we take the, Shackleton is on an expedition. In fact, it had an official name and title, the expedition, and that's, we think of 20th century geography kind of having some of its roots in those expeditions and as a tool of the state too, and mapping expeditions and such. But is this humanist geography? Is what you're talking about here? Is the expedition internal? Is it meditative in today's terms?
Exploration seems external, but
right.
It's an internal aspect. Well, Robert Perry is supposed to have discovered the North Pole.
Uh-huh.
And American Geographical Society rewarded him with the first Cullum Medal. Well, in 1985, the American Geographical Society gave me the Cullum Medal for just the opposite. I never went close to the North Pole. I'm not that sort of geographer. What exploration I did was the mind inside.
Yeah.
So I said teasingly to the American Geographical Society, I said, what a come down from North Pole to what goes on in a person's mind.
But it's new terrain too, right? I mean, you
right,
were
yeah.
a pioneer
right.
Of new terrain, and it's intellectual terrain.
It's a new terrain, and that's where the inspiration came from J.K. Wright, and that's basically, his geography, which is essentially an exploration of the mind, of the interior.
Did geography influence you a lot, or?
It influenced me a lot in the way it opens up a whole way of thinking, but it also helped me because this is what academic life is like, that if you say something that is not part of the mainstream, you're a young guy, you're not likely to be listened to or your work published.
Yeah.
But I had the good fortune to latch on to the famous name of John K. Wright and say, hey, this is not just weird stuff on my own. This began with 1946 paper by Wright.
Yeah.
And that made what I do respectable, acceptable.
Because he was president of the AAG, president of the AGS, I think.
Right. He's well known and much respected,
yeah.
but not followed anywhere.
Yeah, not followed partially because he was never a professor, maybe, or?
Yeah, partly. Maybe that's partly the reason. So Wright's opening up of this inner world is not what was fashionable to do.
Yeah.
The humanist geography or something like it did make headway. In fact, now it's an accepted subdiscipline, and I mean by the AAG and a whole magazine devoted to humanist geography.
Yeah.
But still, when I was still teaching, a colleague said to me, "Hey, you are an entrepreneur," and I was surprised. I didn't see myself as entrepreneur. I thought that's a term for businessman.
Right.
And I wasn't too happy about it. And then I got his meaning. He was saying basically that I was a success in the sense that I managed to keep what Americans call a pa and ma store functioning. Surrounded by skyscrapers.
And the corporate, big box stores around you, yes.
Yeah, right. The skyscrapers are the the social, economic, physical, environmental geography.
Yeah.
They're towering sub-disciplines. But in the middle of it, there's this pa and ma store, totally dwarfed, but nonetheless still there.
Yeah.
That's the compliment.
With a picture of J.K. Wright on the wall, maybe?
Or? Yeah, right.
The association, the most famous association in America, the American Association of Geographers, now has one of its journals is called Geohumanities.
Right, yeah, that's right. So this subdiscipline is making headway.
Yeah.
And so it's no longer a pa and ma store, it's rising.
It's branded.
It's not skyscraper, but multi-story building already.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. Geographical Imaginations is a growing multimedia public geography initiative designed to bring together academic and everyday geographical or spatial thinking. We believe everybody is a geographer and a co-maker of spaces. As an inquiry-based project, we ask questions and explore themes through dialogues with different texts and voices. Inevitably, our explorations return to simple yet complex questions. How does blank inform the way I picture the world in my head? And how does that picture in turn limit or expand my place in the world? The main focus of the project is this hour-long radio essay program broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. In each episode, we make brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. We reflect upon our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. While many of the episodes deal with local and regional topics, themes are somewhat universal, and our investigations could inform the geographical imaginations of those living anywhere in the world. Now let's get back to our episode.
There is something that I keep harboring on, and that is the definition of geography as the study of the Earth as our home.
Yeah.
And this notion fits in with secularization, the world becoming more and more secular. And that is our focus, our interest, great interest in the environment, for instance, that our home, the Earth, should not be polluted, is very central to human geography, to geography as such. I'm a little not too happy with this definition because it has a tendency to minimize the transcendent that I've talked about earlier. Going beyond just maintaining you know, in the university, there's a hierarchy of disciplines, and the discipline that ranked the lowest used to be home economics. But home economics changed its name. It's no longer called home economics. It's called human ecology.
Yeah.
But basically, it's still to keep the home functional and comfortable and maintainable. But that notion has built into environmental studies as such. So all the interesting environmental studies is actually home economics writ large. So
the scale
I find
changed.
This... Right, just the scale changed. But I think the scale should change more. I find this interesting, and that is one of the most popular magazines, that the one you find in, maybe even in airports, is National Geographic.
Right.
It has beautiful photos. But how did it maintain its popularity? It did so by a wild definition of home. I mean, geographic, geo means the earth, right?
Uh-huh.
And in the early issues of the National Geographic, it shows you exotic places, deserts and mountains. But when that became familiar, National Geographic have whole essays and pictures of Mars, the galaxy, and so I said, how can you still call yourself National Geographic
right.
when many of your articles, the most fascinating, go far beyond the Earth? So at first I meant this as a criticism. Then I thought that maybe the National Geographic have a point, because if you define, if you think of the home as not just the material home, and if you think of humans are not just concerned with survival, making the earth clean, but has also the imagination and dwell in that imaginative world, then the notion of home, if it includes home for the mind, is more than the planet Earth.
Yeah.
That's why I was thinking to myself or chatting with geographers that for geography, the notion of home is too limited.
Right.
Interestingly enough, that if one looks at what's called pre-literate peoples, or we even use the word primitive, we condescend to them. They're living a small part of the earth, their life seems limited. But the way I read these ethnographies, actually their notion of the earth, of home, is larger than that. The cosmos is really their home.
Yeah.
I mean, they are deeply concerned about the movement of the sun, the stars. So it's not just the earth, the soil. It's the cosmos that's their home. And so in a way, we modern secular notion of the home is more constrained than even the primitives, because we no longer consider the sun, the stars, as our home.
So what we see in National Geographic is the encounter between someone with a limited notion of this home, trying to figure out then the much more ample cosmological vision of some other society.
It's the basic idea that there's something special about humans, and essentially that's the mind or imagination.
Yeah.
And the result of that is that home is never what secular human geographers think of, and that is the earth, climate, soil, and so on. It's that plus the cosmos. It's always been like that, even in early and primitive societies. Hmm. And so National Geographic is actually doing the right thing by including Mars or galaxy, because that's our home too. Home for the mind.
Yeah. So they're trying to expand this imagination of the home.
Yes, actually, I think Francis Bacon, around 1500,
yeah,
said something similar, that we think of, at that time already, the universe is expanding, that it's huge, and we're just a tiny speck in it. But actually, he said, well, it may be huge, but anything less than that would make us feel claustrophobic, because our mind said, what, is that all? Is the solar system all? It's too small. It's more than enough for the body, but for the mind, it's too constraining. It's our home.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. So one of the questions I like to ask in these conversations is, what does it mean if I say everything has a geography?
Well,
or let me expand that even to not just everything, but everyone in every place has a geography.
The way I've been thinking is that every animal is a geographer. So every animal has, so to speak, some notion of place and space, place being secure, home,
mm-hmm,
nurturing, and space being out there where they have to go to find food.
Yeah.
All animals know how to do that, including humans.
So everyone has this ability to find, to create home, to create meaning on here on Earth? How about to belong? Is that something that, does belonging fit into this?
Belonging has a geographical meaning, and I didn't feel I quite belonged to my big office.
Yeah.
I felt much more that I belonged to the cubicle. Because of the way it seemed to keep my ideas from just floating out into the air and disappear.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's so many ways where place make us feel a sense of belonging. I've just said about my apartment how right now I feel I belong here, and this is weird because people tend to think that to belong you have to belong to a place to feel belongingness. You have to be there for a long time. This has not been my experience. When I moved to the retirement center community 6 years ago, I feel that I'm going to move into a comfortable apartment, but how could I possibly feel that I belong here? It's also, you know, the end stage of life. But curiously, I find that it is possible. Part of the reason is simply the material fact that the apartment has these windows that open out. One of it, lake, which I can see right now,
yeah.
And that's nature. And the other window sees the Capitol dome, which is architecturally quite impressive. So somehow these two objects, and immediately almost within a year or two, I felt, you know, at home here. That I belong here. But I used to go to the campus every day to my cubicle office.
Yeah.
My colleagues who have retired and don't do that. They never appear in their office. They stay home and work.
Yeah.
Or do whatever. So they ask me, why are you always going to the campus? And I say to them, well, you stay at home, but you don't stay in your bedroom all day. You get out of the bedroom, you go to the kitchen for a cup of coffee, walk down the corridor and to your study, and spend some time there. That's your routine. And I say, I'm doing the same. It's just that my corridor is very long. my apartment is my bedroom. And so I get up and walk down State Street and pause at Starbucks for coffee. Starbucks is my kitchen. And then I walk to the study. So I'm doing the same as you do. It's just that my corridor is much longer than yours.
And it might snow in your corridor.
Right, yeah. But what I'm basically saying is that I do this because it has the same kind, almost the same kind of familiarity that's comforting that normally people have at home. And so I come back to the notion of belonging, that I feel a sense of belonging wherever I have established a comfortable routine.
Yeah. So any a location, not to mix up words here, a location that you've made into a place.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So placemaking, a location you've made place, and you have memories there. You feel comfortable there. It means something to you.
Yes. Well, this is not universal, but widespread, and that is, it has these elements of the place where I live, which is a bedroom, for me and serves the very basic requirement of rest. And then I go out and stop at Starbucks to have coffee, and where I also socialize a little bit with fellow coffee drinkers.
Right.
And then I go to the office to study. So what I'm saying is that this routine has the elements that is essential for me. That's why I do it all the time, namely basic nurturing, bedroom, social Starbucks, and thinking alone. That routine.
Well, we've come to the end of a very interesting conversation, the end of our episode here in the two-part series that we're sharing with you, the geographies of everything and the geographies of nothing, our conversation with Yifu Tuan. We want to thank Dr. Tuan for sharing his time with us, his insights, coming at the end of a very, very long career, many different publications and contributions to the field of geography, especially within the human geography side of things, and then within that even humanist geography. So we thank Dr. Tuan for taking the time to sit down with us, as he knows, and as I've shared, his work has definitely blazed the trail for even projects like this. And we thank him for joining us from his home in Madison, Wisconsin. We also want to say in the next 3 months, we will be looking at Cuba a little closer from some field work in the spring. So stay tuned for episodes coming to you from Cuba. Without anything else, thanks for listening. Stay tuned next time. See ya. Bye.